Hello and welcome back to Avatar the Podcast.
Korra Edition.
We are your hosts, Acorn Bandit and Booster Greg.
Hello.
And we're back for another episode today. We are getting so close to the end of book one. This is the second to last episode. The finale is next. I cannot believe it.
I know. I feel like we would never get here, and here we are.
Yep.
Yes.
And things are heating up in the story, so we're going to dive into that in just a second. But first, we have some reviews.
Yes. The first review comes from Squishy Tate Tot. I was like, Tate Tot, Tater Tot is what I wanted to say. It's not that, though. AKA Live with two heart emojis. And they write, oh, geez. Let me math real quick. Carry the four. That is 163,672 out of 10.
Wow.
I guess that's stars. That's insane. Amazing podcast, guys. 2 exclamation marks. I'm 16 and I've grown up watching Avatar with my aunts, uncles, parents, and siblings. I was looking for a new podcast to listen to and was wanting to rewatch Avatar, so I found you. First episode I listened to, I knew this podcast was a keeper. It feels like new Avatar content to listen to, but y'all do it in such a personal and wonderful way. I started listening about 2 months ago and am now finally caught up and am coming over to Spotify to leave a review. I think you mean from Spotify because this is from Apple.
I think so.
Y'all are amazing. Iroh would approve. My top 5 favorite episodes in no particular order are the last 4 episodes because they're one episode in my mind. The Southern Raiders, The Headband, Sokka's Master, Zuko Alone.
Those are all so good.
Sokka's Master. I forget sometimes how much I love that episode.
Yep.
It was just so cool. My top 5 favorite characters are Aang, Sokka, Zuko, Katara, and Toph.
Good top 5 also.
That is a great top 5. Absolutely. Squishy Tate, a.k.a. Liv. Thank you so much for leaving that 5-star written review so I could read it with Acorn.
Thank you. Our next review comes from 88th AJ. Makes me wonder what all the other 87 AJs are like.
What happened to 1 through 87?
They write, great podcast, Hotmans. I love this podcast. I found this amazing and accorable.
Ooh,
that's a new one.
That's accorable. A good one. I like that.
Show earlier this year and have been hooked ever since. I really enjoy how you go into all the background details and your own theories about the show. I would suggest this podcast to every Avatar fan, even if you are not a huge fan of podcasts. I don't really like other podcasts, but I listen to this one almost every day. Keep up the great work and the puns.
Aww. They don't even like podcasts and they like our podcast.
And they're new to the show.
It's so cool.
Wow. That was a very good review as well. Thank you so much, 88th AJ.
Thank you. And 1 through 87, we hope you're okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I hope the 88th AJ has recommended our podcast to 1 through 87. Of the AJs.
You know, I saw a boost in our numbers by exactly 87 numbers.
There you go.
That's on it.
It is. Thank you all so much for the reviews. Again, if you want your review, your 5-star written review read on the podcast, make sure you write it, make it 5 stars, and submit it on Apple Podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Diving into today's episode. It is Skeletons in the Closet, written by Michael Dante DiMartino and Brian Konietzko, directed by our winning duo here, as always, Joaquin Dos Santos and Ki Hyun Ryu. This episode is called Skeletons in the Closet, but what do we like to call it, Greg?
We like to call it My Brother and Me.
We were talking before the episode. I think that was like a show sometime.
It was a show on Nickelodeon in the 90s. So yeah. It feels kind of on brand. I mean, we could have said My Brother and Me, which is also a podcast, but there's only 2 brothers. There's not a third. So the 90s Nickelodeon reference it is, which is on brand.
This episode opens with Hiroshi Sato addressing the equal supporters in front of City Hall with a fleet of mecha tanks standing guard around the square. He proclaims that the city's tyrannical bending government has been overthrown, that bending has been declared illegal, and that Amon has the Avatar on the run. As he talks, we see a giant version of Amon's mask covering the face of Aang's statue on a memorial island, as well as Equals banners draped all over. Hiroshi finally announces that the United Forces are on the way to Republic City, but that they will still prevail in their mission to make the world an equal place for all. As the crowd cheers, 2 chi blockers turn to leave. They head to a cluster of bushes and disappear under a rock that one of them bends to the side. It's soon revealed that the chi blockers are Korra and Mako in disguise. As the pair walks through the metal tunnels under the city, they talk about what they witnessed. Korra is upset with Hiroshi's claim that she's on the run and suggests they go back to knock some heads together. Mako assures her that when General Iroh arrives with his fleet of battleships, they'll have the help they need to face Amon. Korra complains about needing to be patient, but reluctantly agrees.
Felt a little two step forwards, one step back. She's like, I know I have to be patient last episode. And now she's like, man, I don't want to be patient. Yeah. This stinks.
Yeah. She kind of reminds me of your typical character of like, Marty McFly from Back to the Future. Yeah. His weakness is being called chicken.
Oh, yeah.
It's yeah. like, what are you, chicken? And he just like all logic out the window, yes. just fists. And like, I feel like this is very much like one of those moments for Korra. She's just like, he said, what?
He said patient.
He said, I'm on the run. I'm going to show him.
Oh, yeah. That. Yes.
So it's a good thing that she has friends like Mako around to help her remind her to be patient and wait and not just take on the world all by her avatar self. The pair soon arrives at an underground hideout where poor benders and non-benders live together in peace. A place that is called home by the man Korra met in the park on her first day in the city, Gomu. Which, by the way, I don't know if you got this vibe from him, Greg. Gomu reminds me so much of the shopkeeper Doc.
He does. I couldn't put my finger on it. I was like, why do you seem so familiar? And absolutely. Yeah. Zhu and Bushi. Yeah.
Yep. Zhu, Bushi, and Doc. The brothers at the waterside village where the Painted Lady legend is.
I love them so much. I have a weakness for like crazy old men.
You don't say.
Really, Greg?
Really? I've never heard this before. Your undying loyalty and love to Bumi and Iroh, right? Never could have guessed. A cool thing about Gomu's character, too, is he was named after the show had started airing, so he's never actually referred to as Gomu in the show, but he does have a name. That's
good
to
know. I was going
to
say, I don't remember them saying a name, but it's good to know that he has one. Because they got a pretty good voice. I mean, we talked about it on the first time he showed up, but like, they didn't skimp on his voice either, so.
Yeah, remind me who his voice is.
I'm pretty sure it's Steven Root, if I'm not mistaken, who has done a whole bunch of great stuff. And you should refer to the previous episode of Korra for more information on that. It was wonderful, and he does a great job. He really incorporates that crazy old man kind of vibe very all over the place. So, yeah, Steven Root. I just double-checked it because I was doubting myself. I'm in a very doubting myself mood right now. But, yeah, Steven Root from King of the Hill. He was in Kim Possible. I skipped on one. American Dad, West Wing, News Radio.
Awesome.
But you all already knew that. I don't want to talk about his voice acting notes. There are three or two that I'm really excited about for this episode that are coming up.
And I heard one voice and I thought I recognized it. So I'm really excited to hear about these voice acting notes. See if I'm right.
Me too.
That evening in their underground hideout, Korra, Mako, Asami, and Bolin dine with Gomu. And Bolin compliments the hobo on the quality of the mucky stew that he made, claiming it was the best tasting street gruel he's ever had. Gomu enthusiastically tells him that he only pulls ingredients from the finest dumpsters in the city, a proclamation that turns Asami green. Then she spits the food out and quietly puts her dish on the ground, and Pabu comes over and eats it like no problem.
I do appreciate that they keep on reinforcing that Mako and Bolin were at one point street orphans. Like they lived off the street, because Bolin for me is so similar to Sokka. And I feel like Sokka wouldn't enjoy gruel that was made from like rats and such, where, you know, he's very particular about his food. And they really kind of try to illustrate the like, no, Bolin's not just a Sokka clone here. Remember, he's had a tough childhood and he lived off the streets for a while. So he's not as accustomed to higher class things than Sokka might have been. Versus Asami, who is very much used to higher class dining. And so she has that reaction. So I really like how this team avatar is comprised of, and I think I've said this before, is comprised of the same elements as the previous team avatar. They're just arranged differently or they're spread out and amongst different characters. It's really cool.
And it's funny too, because we had a rich girl character in the original group, but it was tough mm-hmm. and she didn't act rich. Mm-hmm. But we have a rich girl character now who's also tough, mm-hmm. like tough, who yep. acts rich. So you're right. It is kind of like a musical chairs type situation with the characterization that we've yes. seen in the past.
I mean, Asami for me is a mix of Toph, Zuko, and a little bit of Sokka.
Yeah. But I like what you just said, because yes, that's the, it was a nice reminder, because now that we've spent most of this book with Team Avatar going out and doing things and like fighting Amon and Chi Blockers and stuff and trying to figure out what's going on with the Resistance and the Equalists, we kind of forget where they came from. It's been a while since we've seen them in the bending arena and yeah. hearing about their life and everything. It is a nice reminder that, like, because they had to live on the streets for so much of their life, they do have this kind of like perspective. Mm-hmm. And it made me realize, like, oh, I guess how many street gruels have they eaten in their life? To be able to say that this is the best one they've ever had.
Yeah.
It is interesting.
This episode also seems to me to be months in the future. I know it's not, but it just has that like vibe of like, this is more far into the future than what we're thinking.
It does feel like that. Yeah. It feels like a lot of time has passed.
Yeah, it's weird.
Later that night, Mako finds Korra leaning against Naga, still wide awake. He joins her, and the Avatar shares that she's still shocked that a few months prior, she was practicing for her firebending test, and now she's in the middle of a war. Mako adds that back then, they didn't even know each other yet. Something that feels bizarre to him now, because he can't imagine his life without Korra in it. The moment builds into something that could lead to a kiss, but Korra turns away and says they should get some sleep. Meanwhile, on Air Temple Island, Amon works through a long line of benders, cleansing them of their impurity one by one. In the line, we see White Lotus members and individuals from Tarlok's task force. This was terrifying. Mm-hmm. It cemented in my mind how systematic and ruthless and like unemotional Amon is.
Yeah, yeah.
And it also, to me, kind of echoed like past historical events where people were targeted for their differences and, you know, subjected to terrible treatments. We have this line of just people rounded up from all over the city and they're forced to stand there and just wait for their bending to be taken away. It's horrifying.
To add on to that, Amon doesn't seem to be getting tired when he takes away people's bending.
Yeah.
It's like zero effort, which is terrifying for me.
Yeah. It makes him feel like a machine that could just keep going until the whole world is cleansed.
Yeah. He's wearing a mask, right? So he could just be like pretending that he's not tired. But I was fully expecting him to have like a towel drenched in sweat over his shoulder. Like, all right, mm-hmm. bring on the next one. But no, it's just, you know, fluid movement. Boom, boom, done. Next.
Yeah. Or even doing like little groups or something. Not this long line that wraps around the island.
Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. How do they even manage that? Like from a logistics standpoint, how many people do you think run?
Like run away from being captured?
They tried to. There are way more benders than there are equalists in the city.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't understand how.
Well, that's also what I was thinking when I saw like White Lotus members in the line.
Yeah.
In Tarlok's task force and stuff. Like, that was my first impression. Like, oh, my God, like White Lotus members yeah. were captured. What's also interesting is all of these benders are in a line standing there, not resisting.
Mm.
That's a lot of benders mm-hmm. to be in one location. If they had worked together, you know, imprisoned style
yeah.
in the original Avatar series, I don't know. Would they have been able to get away? I don't think there'd be enough chi blockers on the island to subdue them again.
It's a little different though. Like, it's a very good shout. Bringing up in prison, because I wasn't even considering that, but that was 100 years of oppression. They're just like, well, we can't win. And they were imprisoned by other benders too. So like, well, we definitely can't win now, but mm-hmm. is Amon's rebellion, for lack of a better term, that so demoralizing to these benders that they've just given up and have accepted their fates?
Right.
Insane.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah. And like White Lotus members of all things.
I know.
Like flashback to the end of book 3 of Avatar The Last Airbender. And like, I mean, yeah, it was like the old man crew of incredible yep. characters.
The League know, of Iroh. Extraordinary Gentlemen for Avatar.
The League of Extraordinary Old Men. Uh-huh. Sure, it was them. But like, that's their legacy. The White Lotus is elites for a reason, because they are comprised of these like very talented, very determined, I guess like idealistic also groups of benders. So the fact that there was a couple that's just standing there in line waiting for their bending to be taken away, like it made it seem like there had been something that happened. Maybe they had been broken in some way, or like you said, demoralized or something.
Yeah, something. I also wonder if there are benders that don't want their bending.
Oh, that's fascinating to think about.
Right? Like, I mean, considering what happens at the end of this episode, and we'll talk about that, right? Like when we get to Tarlok's backstory, I wonder if they're also keeping the other benders in line too.
Oh my God.
Interesting.
I didn't think about that. How many benders in Republic City listened to and internalized Amon's teachings, equalist teachings?
Yeah.
How many benders would start to hate themselves for being benders because they see how this other side is painting them? How many willingly had their bending taken away?
Mm-hmm. And to take it a step further too, we're seeing this unified bending community, but what if Amon's broadcasts and his words have cracked that foundation that Aang set up way back in the comics, right? And now all of a sudden, waterbenders are looking oddly at firebenders, and earthbenders are kind of like, well, what about those waterbenders over there? They're, you know, almost like this racism kind of showing up all of a sudden. And who's to say some of them aren't saying, well, you know, if I lose my bending, at least those shifty earthbenders over there will lose theirs too, and we'll all be on equal playing field.
Yeah, and that's something we haven't seen too much in the show yet, but I do think still exists somewhere. Because like, so far we've seen pro-bending being a mixture of elements. We've seen the different gangs in the city being comprised of people with different elements. But that's not to say that there aren't groups that have banded together around their bending and have kind of feuded with other groups of other elements. With how big Republic City is and how many people are there, I could totally see that being the case.
I know that I'd be very interested to see if they do any more content for Korra, and if they start to dive into this era of rebellion and unrest, but from the point of view of like the everyman, even if it's just like a comic.
Yeah.
Give me something. Even if it's a short story that's only put on Bryke's blog somewhere. Like, give me something. I'm very curious to see what everyday benders were kind of thinking that were not the ones that were terrified for their lives.
Interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, Mako, Bolin, Korra, and Asami emerge from a tunnel on the waterfront where they take up position to wait for the United Forces. Mako spots the boats emerging from the fog in the distance, and the group tenses for an equalist attack. When the airships and mecha tanks don't appear, they realize something is very wrong. Suddenly, explosions ring out in the water where the United Forces ships begin colliding with underwater mines. Korra dives into the water immediately to help them, but soon a buzzing sound fills the air over the city and a squadron of biplanes appear in the sky and begin dropping a volley of bombs into the water. Korra tries to help where she can, dodging bombs and taking out biplanes as quickly as she can. The ships are defeated despite her efforts. When a bomb collides with General Iroh's ship, it launches him into the bay with injuries. Korra rescues him and waterbends them both to safety, where the general thanks her for saving his life.
There's a couple commentary notes here as well.
Ooh, okay.
One of them was that Bryke, I think it was specifically Brian, had to really fight for the score here because Nickelodeon really wanted like action-packed and like, you know, that the typical World War One, World War Two kind of montage there. But you'll notice that the music is a bit more toned down, a bit more somber here. Really kind of illustrating a different side of the war. That's not just like, heck yeah, let's go into fight and action and all this really good. It's more impactful this way. And in the commentary, Zuckerman was just kind of like taken aback that Brian had to fight for it. He's just like, oh, it just makes so much sense to me. And it's so much better, more impactful. And it was actually interesting hearing it because he was more trying to convince Brian, it felt like. And Brian was like, I know, dude. That's why I fought for it. But yeah, and it's also very like World War One, World War Two vibe, which again, like for me, I know I'm being a little negative. It still doesn't sit right for me. They keep on reinforcing these like, inventions. And it's like, this just feels 30 years too soon to me.
Yeah. Also, I'm on the same page with you. I was watching this episode almost with this like feeling of resistance inside of me, because I'm the kind of person, I don't really enjoy stories of war and stories of like, you know, military might and, you know, ships and planes and fighting and like modern technology and stuff like that. I like more of the like organic, pastoral, magical, like people focused type of stories.
Yeah.
So this also has been putting me kind of out of my comfort zone. I'm still enjoying it, but it feels, again, because we talked about this throughout this whole book, it feels so far removed from the original series that it's, even now, the episode before the finale, even now I feel like I'm still adjusting.
I know. Yeah. it's very odd. Breck was also talking about it in the commentary, how they thought people would be more surprised about airplanes existing in this universe. And this was supposed to be like a big reveal. It's like, whoa, airplanes. But it doesn't really sit that way. And I think I've been thinking about this for a couple of days now. I think it's because we already got mecha tanks. Yeah. So like that's more. Also, weirdly enough.
Automobiles.
And cars. And we had warships generations ago in Avatar The Last Airbender. So it's interesting. I will say this. I think the mecha tanks fit in this world a lot better than the airplanes.
Maybe that's what's also bothering me subconsciously. Mm-hmm. Because the inventions we've seen throughout Avatar itself are based on real life things like zeppelins and hot air balloons and tanks and stuff, but their design is so specific to the world. Like think back to, what was it, book two, book three of Avatar the Last Airbender, when we were seeing the Fire Nation producing all of these different vehicles and stuff. They looked recognizable. You can look at something and go, oh, that's a tank. But the fact that the tanks could flip over and they have like the little like what's it called? It shoots out the hooky thing on the rope.
Like the grappling hook. But yeah, I know what you mean.
Grappling hook.
It's not grappling. It's a word for it. It's not a winch.
That's the thing that turns it.
Oh, is it? I thought a wench.
I think a wench is the thing that turns.
It was a barmaiden. That's what I thought. Serves you alcohol in a D&D campaign, right? Well, it's a wench.
I mean that too. But just like the designs looked like they were created in the world.
Yes.
And I think that is also, I didn't realize, I couldn't put my finger on it until you said that. That is also what's distracting me, because they feel like they've been plucked out of our real world history.
Yeah.
And that makes it harder for me to suspend my disbelief when it comes to this narrative, this story, world setting, all this stuff.
Maybe we'll get used to it in three more seasons.
Maybe. We'll see.
Hopefully.
We'll see. Well, it depends on how long the Equalists stick around, I think.
Well, I mean, just because the Equalists go away doesn't mean that all this technology goes away.
That's true. It's just going to be picked up by someone else. I mean, Hiroshi's the one who made all this. That means there's blueprints all over the place to be passed along.
That's true.
Also, I laughed out loud at the line, where does Hiroshi find the time to invent new evil machines?
Yeah.
It really does feel like he has just been like Santa Claus or something, making like all these evil inventions in his little workshop.
He just wakes up at 3 a.m. in a cold sweat. Oh, I know a new murder machine to make against these benders.
Yep, exactly.
Hiroshi.
Well, sadly, reinforcements are now completely defeated and the ships have sunk to the bottom of the bay. But General Iroh was saved. So the group brings him back to the underground hideout. And Korra heals his wounds. General Iroh recounts how he'd come prepared to fight mecha tanks, but not the new biplanes. Korra commiserates, remarking that whenever they think they have an advantage, Amon surprises them with something new. General Iroh remains hopeful in their eventual victory, though, stating a second wave of reinforcements is on its way to Republic City. He then asks if they have a way to send someone a message, and Korra introduces him to Gomu and the hobo's salvaged telegram machine. General Iroh relays a message for Commander Bumi of the 2nd Division of the United Forces, and Aang's eldest son, saying the commander should retreat to Red Sand Island until the general's all-clear sign.
I know no one wants to hear this, but I'm still thinking about our conversation from last episode where I'm like, so Bumi is not an airbender then, because if all the airbenders were on the island and now the next episode we're getting a reference of Bumi, he can't possibly be an airbender.
Yeah, he's not an airbender.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so. But I would find it very interesting if he could bend another element that wasn't water, because then that would indicate that the being the descendant or even son of an avatar, that bending gets split out based off of genetics and not necessarily based off of spirituality or anything. It's very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I also thought a lot about that conversation. I'm still pretty like solid on where we landed.
Yes, me too.
If you have two parents who are of some sort of bending, those two options are in the mix. But you also have the option of them being a non-bender too. So it's really three options of how your kids are gonna pop out.
And if you're the avatar, it's like six.
Yeah, I do wonder if being the avatar means that it's just like a roulette of like whatever kind of outcome. I was interested in hearing Commander Bumi mentioned. Mm-hmm. I still have this like feeling of we're meeting all these characters who are named after the original cast, but they're already grown up. They've already have entire full lives. And it's kind of like, wait, Commander Bumi is second division commander of the United Forces. He's been like out in the world, like living his life this whole entire time. It feels like it's going to be too late to like meet him and see what's going on in his life. But I don't know.
It's never too late in this world. People live to like 3,402. I'm exaggerating.
They don't.
They live into like their hundreds.
Exaggerating by a couple thousand years, maybe.
They live to be like close to or upwards of 100 years old. Mm-hmm. So like even if he's Tenzin's older brother, that would only put him at most 10 years older than Tenzin.
Yeah.
So we would have like a good amount of time to learn about him, I feel like.
50, 60.
Maybe. I mean, I'm not really mathing this out with Aang, we know, dying younger than previous iterations of the Avatar, more specifically Kyoshi, but, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The general then consults a map of Republic City and tells the others they must prioritize grounding the Equalist aircraft to allow Commander Bumi to even reach the city with his fleet. They reason that the airfield must be over the nearby mountain range based on the direction that they flew in. Korra tells the others she can't go with them in the morning. She's tired of hiding from Amon and wants to face him, a plan that the general does not agree with at first. When Mako decides to go with her, General Iroh then reflects that his grandfather, Zuko, would have gone with the Avatar's instincts, and because of that, so will he.
That I found interesting, that line, because Zuko did not always go along with Aang's plans. And that feels very revisionist history.
Well, it feels like what it feels like to me, because you do bring up a good point. It feels like idealized.
Oh, history. Yes.
The way that you would take what you know about your grandparents, for instance, and just kind of like further map out their lives based on what you know of them in their old age. When in fact, when they were younger, they would have made different decisions. They wouldn't have always done things the way you'd expect them to, because they were human beings growing up and like maturing through life.
It's also the last time we heard from Team Avatar, that iteration was in the comics, which was 40 years ago, 30 years ago, something like that, however long it was. So it must be more than that. How old is, it doesn't matter. But we will probably see more of this. And hopefully that Zuko does start to go along with Aang without question a bit more. Because I actually heard that for Avatar Studios, the next Aang gang movie, they're going to be in their 20s or 30s, which is super exciting.
That's so exciting.
Which is like right what I was hoping for, like right in that mid spot there. So we'll find out.
Can't wait for more stories to fill in the blanks, fill in this time gap that we're struggling with still, even with the comics.
But I found that interesting. He's like, is my grandfather always one? Did he? Did he though?
My grandfather completely and utterly every single time respected the Avatar's wishes and thoughts and ideas. Therefore, you should have seen him.
I will say this. I am starting to marry the voice of Zuko to the body of Commander Iroh more and more at every time they speak. And I've been paying attention to the drawings and I feel like they're shrinking him down a little bit more to like Zuko sized. as it goes. That first time we saw him, he was very broad. And yeah. I've been trying to like size him up against the rest of Team Avatar, just like to make this make sense. And it's been working. Like, he's not as large as I thought he would be. He's only a little taller than Mako.
Yeah.
So it makes a little more sense now. Now I'm hearing Zuko a little less, good. Which is good.
Korra and Mako change into their Equalist uniforms and head to Air Temple Island, where they see Amon's airship taking off. They're stopped by the lieutenant, who tells them Amon wants extra security to the arena and to report there. After he leaves, however, Korra sneaks herself and Mako into the temple using a secret entrance and goes to hide in the attic. But when they enter, they find Harlock sitting behind bars. They ask the disgraced council member if there are other prisoners on the island, to which he says no. When Korra asks haughtily what makes him so special, Harlock replies that he is Amon's brother.
Hmm?
Dun, dun, dun. Dun, dun, dun.
I knew it. This is the one thing I remembered from this season.
Oh, really? Uh-huh. I completely forgot.
I was like, I'm pretty sure they are. And then when the bloodbending happened.
Yeah.
With Tarlok, I was like, yes, no, I'm remembering this correctly.
I remember that moment. And you would not tell me what you remembered.
Mm-mm, it was this specific one. Yep. And this is why it makes so much sense that Amon didn't go after Korra in the cabin.
Yeah.
Because he had his brother. So he wanted to make sure that he didn't wake up and go, I know who you are in front of all of his men.
Mm-hmm.
And B, I think that he still has a soft spot for his younger brother. And so he wanted to make sure that even though he took away his bending, which in Amon's mind is a good thing, he wanted to make sure that, like, you know, his forces didn't kill his brother.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Shocked by this news, Korra and Mako listened to Tarlok's story. One that begins after Yakon had lost his bending to Avatar Aang. Yakon escaped prison and underwent surgery to change the appearance of his face. He then went into hiding in the Northern Water Tribe, where he fell in love, married, and had two sons with a Northern Tribe woman. The elder son was Noatak, or Amon, and the younger son was Tarlok. Small note, I feel like, I'm so sorry, listeners. I feel like I am being more critical than I
Stop
normally...
Stop being so negative, Acorn. I can't believe you.
I'm being so negative and critical. I just when it showed him getting his facial surgery, I'm like, what?
Oh my God.
Wait,
I'm
what?
I'm so happy you said that.
That's convenient and also like directly pulled from some of our modern movies.
Mm-hmm. It's Face Off with John Travolta and Nick Cage.
Yes.
I thought this was a wasted opportunity, and I'm pretty sure the comics came after this, but I thought it'd been really cool if like Yakon had the forces to track down the Mother of Faces and then she gave him a new face instead
Stop
of just,
it.
That would have been so cool.
Greg.
Uh-huh.
That would have been amazing.
I know, but no, he just got weird surgery that made him 10 years younger and dyed his hair.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Okay. This is hitting on exactly the thing that I'm frustrated with about this series. It feels like all of the magical hidden mysteries in the world feeling is just ripped out of the world.
I think that's there on purpose, though, because we are, this whole story does take place on the grave of, General Old Iron.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's taking place on his corpse, essentially. So, like, it's almost poetic that, like, we're feeling that disconnect. It's frustrating for us. But it feels purposeful, maybe?
It does. Okay.
But
framing it like that, it
does feel like
that.
I definitely share your frustrations. I want to make that clear. And you, like, you're correct. But, like, I think that might be on purpose.
Thematically, it makes sense.
Yes.
We are in a new era, a new time period, modern technology. And honestly, like, this also parallels the way that we see, like, folklore and culture in our own world. The more progressed we get, the more modern we get, the further away from our roots we are. So legends, mythologies, fairy tales, fables, those are further away from our mindset because we're so focused on the modern and the new and the technological. So yes, you're right. But it's also, for me personally, as an individual viewer, taking away my favorite thing about Avatar. Like, oh my God, coming up with like cool solutions for these situations, like showing that there's still this magical quality, like breathing in the world. Like it would have made such a big difference to me. But at the same time, now that I'm saying that, thinking thematically, everything we've seen about Republic City, it also wouldn't really fit because we have spent our whole book inside of a city, a modern, typical, boring city. I'm like, take me back into the world, please. I don't want to learn about shops and police forces and sports. It's just me, though. It's just me.
That's fair. I am looking this up right now. Yeah. The comic did come out 2 years after it aired, after at least episode one of Legend of Korra aired.
Well, so there you go.
They didn't think of Mother Faces then, potentially. Yeah. But
there's still, like, okay, fine. Because Ko is the face stealer and Mother of Faces grants new faces. Yeah. Okay.
It could have been Ko too. I mean, they could have used Ko and they could have repurposed Ko. Like, who's to say that he can't grant people other faces as well?
Yeah.
Other than just stealing.
That would be an interesting face off. Your cone, you know, bullheaded boss man.
Yeah.
Approaching Ko and like striking up some kind of deal.
You kind of would 100% have the resources to just pay people to wait by each of the pools for the Mother of Faces, though. And let him know when she shows up.
Totally.
But yeah, just like it is missing. It's on purpose, I think, but it's missing. And who knows? Maybe we'll learn more about spiritual stuff in later seasons.
Yeah. No, we do.
I know. I was trying not to spoil it for you just in case you didn't hear.
No, I do remember. I do remember.
Loyal viewers. That's... Who knows? Wink.
Yeah. That's also part of my issue based on what I remember, because it felt like whiplash. Like very violent whiplash of like, we are in the magical world of Aang, and then we're in a completely modern world with no magic, and then we're whipped back to the magical world that predated Aang, and like there's spiritual concepts and creatures and like magic and all these things, and I'm just like, I'm dizzy.
Me too.
But again, dear listeners, I'm sorry. This is my own personal opinion. I'm still going to do my best to enjoy the series. We're going to talk about it. And you know, make the most of it, even if my personal preferences are getting in the way now.
Yeah. It's all right. You just have to be less negative. That's all.
I'll work on that, Greg. Anyway, Tarlok explains that life was fine until the time he and his brother realized they were waterbenders. This discovery changed their father's demeanor. He began training them relentlessly, obsessed with the concept of his sons taking over his plot of revenge. When Tarlok was 7 and Noatak was 10, Yakone took them out on a hunting trip. It was here that Yakone revealed his identity to his sons and told them they were descended from the strongest line of bloodbenders in history, a legacy that he planned on training up in the both of them. Cool note about the music here, similar to what you were saying about the music being very intentional during the fighting scene to help underline and underscore the severity of war. The music here was also very intentional. It's called Before. The theme is called Before. And it's a duet comprised of a cello and an erhu, where each instrument represents a character, the cello representing Noatak and the erhu representing Tarlok. I love little details like that because it helps enhance the emotion of the scene. So even if you don't consciously realize what's going on, it still has this like emotional impact in the background in your brain.
Oh, absolutely. And in the commentary too, they were kind of talking about how it didn't sound great as like a draft, but Zuckerman was just like, you just gotta trust me. And they were like, yeah, well, I mean, we've been working with you for over a decade or however long it's been. Like, of course we're going to trust you on this. Like, you know, your stuff, you know it better than us, even though, they did point out they're all musically inclined between Brian and Mike, but they're just kind of like, yeah, of course we're going to trust you on that, man. Like, you've not done us wrong so far. Like, why wouldn't we? So I thought that was a really cool trusting moment. I'm going to get the three voice acting notes out of the way right now.
Yeah, let's do it.
There are, in this flashback, we see Noatak and Tarlok at different ages. At Noatak at age 6, 8, and 10 is voiced by Jacob Bertrand. And if you think that name sounds familiar, you would be correct if you've ever seen Cobra Kai. He plays Hawk, Eli Hawk Moskowitz. He was the guy with the kid with Mohawk.
Oh, okay.
So he's really cool. He's also been in a couple different other things. He was in Ready Player One, is like a high school kid. He's kind of been around for a while. Oh, not like a while, but for longer than you'd think, surprisingly enough. He was in an episode of Community as well. So that was, I know him as Hawk, first and foremost. Oh, remember, I don't know if you remember this. There's a show called The Cape. It was a very short-lived superhero. And it was before, like, superheroes really took off. So they just made up superheroes. And it was not very good looking. It didn't get very far, but he was also in that. A little bit older, Noah Talk is Alexander Martella, who I don't know if you would know this voice, because this actor has two voice credits to their name. One of them is Noah Talk. The other one is from my favorite DC animated movie, Batman Under the Red Hood. He voiced a young Jason Todd, who is the second Robin. So that was really cool. And lastly, which this might be who you recognize, because you were saying earlier, the voice of Tarlok, a little bit older, is Zach Callison, who is the voice of Steven Universe. So I think that might be who you recognize.
I'm Googling and it's not.
It's not?
The one that I thought was familiar, it was when Noah Talk was standing up to their father, which we're going to get to in a second. It sounded like the voice of Haku from Spirited Away, the English voice, who apparently is Jason Marsden. That's who I thought it was.
No, it's not. But we got Steven Universe out of that. He also voiced Billy Batson in Justice League War. And he was also in the show The Goldbergs as Brian Corbett, which I've not seen The Goldbergs, but I know it's been around for a while.
Cool.
Yeah.
Good voice acting credits. Mm-hmm. As the years went by, Yacone took his sons out on more hunting trips during the full moon to train them in bloodbending on wild animals, a secret they all kept from the boy's mother. Noah Talk learned the psychic technique of bloodbending quickly, becoming a master at the mere age of 14, while Tarlok hated every minute of the training. Soon they learned how to use the technique without the aid of the full moon. And finally, the brothers were forced to bloodbend each other. Noah Talk obeyed, but Tarlok refused. Yacone began to berate his younger son, but Noah Talk came to his brother's defense, bloodbending their own father to stop his wrath. Noah Talk challenged Yacone, saying bloodbending wasn't the most powerful thing in the world, as his father claimed, because if the Avatar could take someone's bending away, what could be more powerful than that? Yacone, struggling against the force Noah Talk was exerting over his body, ground out through clenched teeth that he made Noah Talk who he was. Noah Talk reminded his father that he and Tarlok were his sons, not his tools of revenge. Noah Talk turned to his brother and told him they should run away, but Tarlok was concerned about leaving their mother behind, something Noah Talk took as betrayal. Calling his brother a weakling, Noah Talk ran away into the wilderness.
In the commentary, Bryke made a point to point out that even though they use the trope of evil dads almost seemingly whenever they can, their fathers are actually wonderful individuals and they have nothing but good memories of their fathers. So,
well, that's good to know.
That's good to know, because at this point I was kind of thinking, I was like, you guys okay? You digging up something over there? You working through something? But yeah, also here, this is something clicked for me. It's not something that I don't think they really mentioned as much or put into the forefront. Amon doesn't hate benders. He hates the idea of bending itself, which seems to be a lot different from his followers. Like if you think about Hiroshi and you think about a lot of the followers that we've seen so far, and they make a point to say why they are a part of the Equalist Party.
Yep.
They always say like, well, you know, like a firebender killed my wife or something, or like, you know, they're always bullying us. And Amon doesn't hate a specific bender. There's not his dad, I guess, but his dad wasn't a bender, I would argue, when they were born. So, but he just hates the idea of bending itself, which he finds it imbalances the world when it's meant to balance the world. And it's just like, I had not really considered his philosophy until seeing his backstory.
Yeah, that's a really good point that I don't think fully clicked for me, but you're right. This kind of goes, I mean, this circles back to, and this is probably where you got it from. We were talking about the line of benders and considering like how many benders in Republic City hate their bending and want it to be taken away. I mean, that's essentially what's happening with Amon. He hates this part of him. And that narrative of like self-loathing and self-hatred is a really interesting one that I don't think is explored very often. And I almost, it's not even fully explored here. It's just more inferred than anything.
I find it also very interesting how cold and emotionless he is when he's doing these things, when he's bending wolves, right? Like he's bloodbending wolves and they're mm-hmm. whimpering and it's painful to watch.
I hated that.
I hated it. I watched this episode four times and each time I was like, oh no. And like, at least they show that they're okay afterwards. Yeah. And in the commentary, it did help me a little bit kind of like power through this. I hate watching dogs get hurt.
Me too.
Like any thing like that. But in the commentary, they were like, you know, it doesn't really like hurt. It just feels like weird. It's yeah. just like an unsettling feeling that you're yeah. not in control of your own body. So like no one gets hurt by bloodbending. It's just feels off. So I'm like, okay. Yeah,
that's good.
And that's what they're reacting to is that they've never felt that before. Okay, yeah. we're fine. We're fine now, Greg. This is so good. Yeah, it's like he's using this super powerful bloodbending method and he just doesn't care, seemingly, whether like he's masking or not. I don't know.
That's to be determined. But that's the part that I think stood out to me more is the psychological effect on Noah Tok because of the way their father treated them.
Yeah.
He was forced to essentially turn into a robot. Mm-hmm. He was forced to perform. And regardless of how he was feeling, he had to do it. So I think from an early age, especially since at that age, they're still developing as like people and their brains are developing, he learned that it's probably safer, easier, whatever the word is, to just turn that part of your brain off and just perform and just do the thing that is required of you, which is terrible.
Also, the meta of having Clancy Brown be the father of Steve Blum is just amazing for me.
Explain that to me.
So like, they're just both great voice actors. So like Clancy Brown did the voice of Yacone. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you have this great voice actor in the Avatar universe be the father of another great voice actor is just like really cool to me. Like, of course, like the prominent son is going to be have that awesome voice, you know, like that's just, that's a nice touch for sure.
Yeah. Okay. I see what you mean.
They have very similar registers in that they both have that like deep, like gravelly, really rich voice to them.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. For days, Yacone and Tarlok looked for Noah Tok, but finally assumed he'd perished in the storm. Tarlok's mother never recovered, and his father's hopes for revenge withered with Noah Tok's absence. Yacone passed away a few years later. Back in the present, Tarlok apologizes to Korra for his past actions, stating that while he thought he was better than his father, it turns out his father's ghost still shaped him into a soldier of revenge. And while Amon's revolution may be built on a lie, his brother seems to truly believe that bending is the source of all evil in the world. Mako asks how Tarlok was able to tell that Amon was his brother, and the man replies that the sensation of his bending being taken away felt familiar to him because he recognized it as his brother's bloodbending grip. Korra realizes that this means Amon is using bloodbending to take people's bending away. Tarlok acknowledges that he has no idea how Amon is doing it, but he's also never encountered a bender as strong as Noah Tok before. Korra wonders how they're supposed to beat someone that strong, and Mako replies that they can't. Any attack they throw his way will be redirected. Korra agrees, but realizes that this actually gives them the advantage. They know the truth about him now, and if they can reveal that all to his supporters, they could take away his true power and influence. Before leaving, Korra thanks Tarlok and hesitates about leaving him there, but the council member insists that their plans would be endangered if Amon ever found out someone spoke with him. He urges her to defeat Amon and put an end to the sad story.
I don't like their plan.
I don't like their plan either. I'm glad you feel the same way.
It feels like it could get so much worse.
Yeah. If you bring the truth to light, you might be able to sway some people. But Amon is so smooth. Amon is so smart and so capable. I could easily, my first thought was he'll turn around and be like, yes, this is true. However, I, a bender, recognize how terrible bending is for the world. And who better than me to lead us into this new future?
Maybe,
like, he could spin it so fast and so easily. And his followers are already so deep in his indoctrination that they like they'd be like, okay.
Okay, sounds good.
Yeah. Anyway, what's our next move?
Yeah, I'm more worried of the opposite, that they'll see this and go, and someone else will come out of the woodwork, someone who's not an actual bender, who will end up being even more dangerous
to take over the
Amon's role. Yeah, because like Amon, as devious as he is, he has principles, and he's guided by those principles, as misguided as they might be, right? But like, he's not going to like hurt non-benders. Like, he has a code.
That's true. Yes. And I love when, by the way, side note, I love when villains have a code.
Yes. Me
like
too.
Like that. Yeah. That makes sense.
But I'm just worried that someone's going to crawl out like, what's his name? Gilgamesh. What the heck was his name? Gligar? Gilmer? I can't remember his name. Happy Gilmore and
Gregory,
George. I don't remember his name, but that guy who like was seemingly more dangerous because he just didn't have any real principles to kind of guide any, and he just ended up lashing out towards the end of the comic.
Yeah, yeah.
And that combined with all of those equalists and all of that power, all of that technology is, for me, infinitely more terrifying. Mm-hmm. I mean, we'll see how it plays out, like you said. But I was just like, eh, they might just go, oh, wait, you're a bender. And this guy goes, yeah, I'm not a bender. And why don't we just destroy the whole planet? They're just popping out of nowhere, you know?
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Yeah. So we'll have to see how this plan works out in the next episode, which, again, is our finale.
Uh-huh.
But until then, or before then, Greg, who is your MVP of this episode?
Oh, man. I want to say, as much as it pains me, I think it has to be Tarlok.
Same thought.
Yeah.
This was really tough. I was like, who is the MVP in this episode? And I think it has to be Tarlok.
Yeah. He really like moved the plot forward. Like him divulging his backstory, which he didn't have to do by any stretch.
No.
But he recognized how wrong he was and how wrong his brother is, and that things need to go back to kind of the way they were. In a way, not like fully. I think he would still be like, you know, let's maybe talk about what happened here and and brainstorm and come to a conclusion, because obviously not everyone is happy. But he told his backstory. It made him a lot more sympathetic. Even Amon, for me, it made a lot more sympathetic. Mm-hmm. And it was just a well-done scene. He's a well-done character. Like, he's a great villain. It's just another great example of Reich's writing coming into full view here. Like, I loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I especially like the fact that he has this moment of recognition and realization that even though he went into like taking over Republic City and leading it in a completely different way than his father, which up until now he thought was morally right, morally correct. Like, I'm doing it the right way, the way my father wouldn't have done. And I'm going to make a difference. And I'm going to lead the city in the way that it needs to be led. He eventually realizes like he still was carrying out his father's plans of revenge. Mm-hmm. He was still a soldier for his father. And it takes a lot to have that kind of realization and to recognize the error of your ways. So the fact that he recognized that and was able to provide context and information, and more importantly, the truth to Amon that could turn the tides. I think that exactly is what makes him MVP of this episode.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely. What about the moral of the episode?
Isn't there a quote about sins of the father or something?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's that. I mean, the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. There's just something to be said about generations here. And I'm not articulate enough to really kind of say that in any meaningful way, but they're just hitting on this idea of yet again generational trauma.
Yeah, this is the father visited upon the children, according to Google.
It's very much that. I think for me, and I'm looking at it through the lens of a parent as well, and it just kind of goes to show you that this one's to the parents out there, I guess. Your goals, if you have any for your child, may not be your child's goals. And I think that's, it's important to recognize that. And if you're already on a path and you realize that, don't double down, just like drop it, I guess. I think that's kind of what they're saying here.
Yeah. Because Yacone was trying to micromanage and pathfind for his sons.
Yacone was a pageant mother.
Holy, yes. He was a freaking pageant mom. Oh my God. Yes. That's what it was.
Mm-hmm. Not all. I'm generalizing, obviously, which is going to get me in trouble, but like everyone understands.
The worst of that group.
Yes.
Specifically. Not the wholesome, supportive, loving pageant moms, but the ones who are power hungry and fame hungry and like exploiting their children moms. Mm-hmm.
Or if you want me to go on the other side of the aisle as well, I can. The football dad, the dad who didn't make it as a football star and now wants their kid to be and all you. The kid wants to do a sing in Glee Club.
Yes,
which is also the premise of Glee before on the characters. But, so, you know, it's that, you know, that I think that is the moral.
Yeah. And I think where I landed is what you were originally starting to say, which is from the perspective of a child who underwent trauma and mistreatment. It is kind of up to you to break the cycle because it is so much easier to just continue on with the lessons you were taught and to perpetuate them and not do that self-exploration and have that self-awareness to realize, oh, what I'm doing is wrong. It's just like what my parent did to me. I should do something different. I should be better. And it takes a lot to be able to see that, recognize it, and then make the choice to change and to heal from that.
Yeah. How interesting too that Yacone got his way in the end.
That's rough.
That's rough, buddy.
But with that, that is today's episode. Fun time. It took us all that time to finally get the lore on Amon, but it was good. It was good lore.
So good, juicy, and delicious. I loved it every moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. And remember, if you're caught up on all of the episodes as well, you can hang out with me over twitch.tv/BoosterGreg on Monday and Friday evenings at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Don't worry about Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Don't have to worry about that. We've been playing a lot of different games recently. It's been a lot of fun. We've been just kind of winging it, just seeing where fate brings us. We beat Suicide Squad Kill the Justice League, which was a lot of fun. We also played the demo for Pacific Drive, which was kind of interesting. And we're just going about it. We're talking, hanging out, having a good time. You should swing on over. Also, thank you everyone who's been following recently. We just hit over 1,000 followers last week. So that was really cool. Thank you everyone so much. It's super cool. But yeah, that's where you can find me. And anywhere on the internet, that's Booster Greg.
Yep.
Yeah.
You can also find me over on Twitch at twitch.tv/acornbandit, where I am doing all things Minecraft. We are making progress on my massive project of building Mushroom Kingdom from the Mario movie in the Minecraft survival world. I was clearing out a lot of the valley the other day by hand and just having a moment where I'm like, should I be doing this with my life? What have I signed up for? What did I do? What have I done? It's going to be a massive project, but it's also really gratifying. Even designing the castle in a creative world has been like super fun. Yeah. So anyway, that's what you can find over there. And I really appreciate everyone who's been stopping by and saying, hey, every once in a while, I'll get someone from the podcast coming in just being like, hi.
It's so cool.
I'm from the podcast.
I know. I love it.
Yeah, okay. I love it too. Mm-hmm. But thank you all for being here. Thank you for listening. We will see you next time on Avatar
the podcast.
Avatar, the podcast, is a proud part of the Geek Generation Network. Remember to check out all of our podcasts at thegeekgeneration.com.